Midweek Wednesday, July 22nd on Connecticut Today, we spoke with an Ohio State professor about his new book that centers on the American middle class. What does that mean politically and economically? We spoke with a producer from EWTN, that's the Catholic channel on your cable or satellite system, regarding a major move made by Planned Parenthood. We also gave you portions of Governor Ned Lamont's briefing from Pfizer in Groton about Pfizer's proposed contract with the government for a possible coronavirus vaccine. This guest, a professor at the Ohio State University. He's written about New Deal liberalism, conservative thinking from the 40s to the 1960s, and suburbia as well. His new book, Promised Land, How the Rise of the Middle Class Transformed America from 1929 to 1968. We welcome to the show Professor David Stebbin. Professor, hi, Paul here at WICC. How are you?
I'm all right. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate that, Professor. The middle class, boy, that phrase gets tossed around, especially at election time, like it's, bags of Skittles and Starburst and M&Ms here. Professor, in your mind, what when we use the term middle class, what does that mean? Maybe from a political point of view and from an economic point of view. Start us off there.
Well, let me go first with economics and then with politics. So in the era that I'm talking about, and in general, in modern American history, most Americans tend to think middle class means people who cannot fairly be described as either rich or poor. Mm-hmm. And in the era that I talk about, by the mid-1950s, roughly 60%, the middle three-fifths of the income distribution, fit that description. So it would be more prosperous blue-collar workers, of whom there were many in Bridgeport at that time,
yeah,
and sort of lower middle class office workers. So not really upper middle class professional people and beyond. Those people, by world historical standards, are pretty affluent. But mm-hmm. people with ordinary incomes, but who really weren't poor by any real measure and who were not rich either, but who were comfortable in an era that was sort of organized around the needs and aspirations of middle income people like them. And politically, yeah, it meant people in the middle of the spectrum. And in the 1930s, a lot of those folks voted for Franklin Roosevelt because his New Deal, in response to the Great Depression, helped put in place policies that helped expand the middle class, bank deposit insurance that helped stabilize the savings of middle class people, Social Security to help them save better for old age. But there was a Republican version as well, mm-hmm. and by the 1950s, the leading example of that was Dwight Eisenhower. And on election night in 1956, the pollsters and pundits declared that Eisenhower had been successfully reelected when the voters of Bridgeport, Connecticut, voted for him. Mm-hmm. Right? In other words, and Bridgeport being a very middle-class kind of place in those days, they liked Ike. Generally speaking, because he was responsive to class concerns. He had a kind of middle-class background himself.
Interesting. You know, I as kind of a hobby here, being in radio for so many years, I listen to old radio programs, old commercials, radio serials, news reports, and you always hear, Professor, the middle class and the historians tell us that the influx or the growth of the middle class came after, you know, all the boys came home from World War II, you know, Levittown and all that on Long Island. Here came more disposable income, a great expansion of America. But I do find it interesting, you go many decades or a couple of decades before that. You mentioned you start out, you look at the middle class, 1929. So you peg that in the Depression years? Was that your starting point purposely?
Well, it's the start of the Great Depression, generally yeah. speaking, with the collapse of the stock market in the fall of 1929. And at that time, the United States had a lot of income and wealth inequality, very much like today. The reason I start there is because the kind of values in the late 1920s, the fondness for risk and high reward and entrepreneurialism and so on, very quickly, the onset of the Great Depression changed things. The arrival of double-digit unemployment as a sort of lasting social problem really changed attitudes. And as the banks became weaker, economic insecurity became much more common. And so the growth of the middle class, in some sense, begins in the 1930s with that change in outlook. We want the government to do more to tame the wildness of the markets and stabilize the economy, and less risk, more stability and security. And there's a political dimension to this, because in 1929, the president at that time, Herbert Hoover, he was an amateur politician. He'd never run for politics for any office until he ran for president in 1928. And he came from the business world, and he did not expect the Great Depression. And his response to the beginning of it was to say that it would be brief, that it would not be a long-term problem, and to put most of the responsibility for caring for those who were harmed on the states and the local governments, which was the American tradition at that point. And then, as and bizarrely, in some ways, at first it seemed as though he might be right. The stock market had a rally in 1930 and so on. And he argued that, you know, this is going to end fairly briefly and didn't require any major changes in American life. And then the trauma of the stock market crash didn't make the Depression great all by itself, but the system was fragile in a variety of ways. And once stocks collapsed, it sort of knocked over a bunch of other dominoes. And so the economic problems that grew out of that grew steadily worse. And then President Hoover was at his least attractive. In other words, he sort of hunkered down, dug his heel, became defensive. He said the Europeans were to blame for the Great Depression, that sort of thing. And the voters got mad, and they tossed him out. And they chose instead someone who seemingly had been around forever, a career politico, Franklin Roosevelt. And again, career politicians have their pluses and minuses. One of the pluses is they tend to be skilled at figuring out what voters want and trying to give it to them. And so Franklin Roosevelt was perceived as more responsive to the call for the federal government to do more, to help. And so that change in attitudes, more of a role demanded of the federal government, more emphasis on public policies that made it easier to get into the middle class and stay there, that was a very big change. But you are correct in the sense that until the 1940s, there's no big expansion. In other words, the Depression lingers across the 30s. And then the war comes along. And you can fight wars in different kinds of ways. But World War II was fought in a New Deal-ish way. Taxes on the affluent are high. Wages paid to workers in the factories are high. And so by the end of the war, Roosevelt had also pushed through a very generous benefits program for veterans, the GI Bill. And all of those things came together after the war to help this great big expansion of the middle class.
Professor, hang on. This is fascinating. Professor David Stebbin, folks, you would think he's talking about stuff today, but you could interchange it to the era of 1929 to 1968, Promised Land, How the Rise of the Middle Class Transformed America, 1929 to 1968. Professor, hang on, back with you after we do traffic and weather together. 316 on the sixes here on WICC. And 87 degrees in Greater Bridgeport. Once again, a reminder, National Weather Service issuing a severe thunderstorm watch, southern Fairfield and New Haven counties until 10 p.m. this evening. So if you're going to be out there, just be careful. Okay. A few more minutes with Professor David Stebbin of Ohio State University. And the name of the book, of course, is Promised Land, How the Rise of the Middle Class Transformed America, 1929 to 1968. Boy, Professor, when I look back on what you just said in the first half of what we talked about and hearing these themes and other guests I have on, economic insecurity, wild fluctuations on Wall Street, things like stock market crashes vis-a-vis pandemics that we have. Of course, the world just came out of the pandemic back then, 9 years earlier. A lot of the stuff in history really does kind of repeat itself, doesn't it?
Well, the interesting thing about where we are now really is primarily the result of the sudden return of high unemployment. Because for a long time, a lot of historians and economists said, you know, the 30s is a unique experience. You had double-digit unemployment for an extended period. and that'll never happen again. And as recently as December of this past year, they seem to be absolutely right. As amazingly to me, the December unemployment rate in the United States was 3.5%. And then suddenly, unexpectedly, it went into double digits again. And the head of the Federal Reserve, Mr. Powell, seems to be suggesting that that could be with us for quite some time. And so there's no way to know for sure at this point, and no one wants it to stay high. But it's just a reminder that if a system has weaknesses, vulnerabilities economically, and then it's stressed by some unexpected event, it can have far-reaching consequences. And so in terms of the parallel with today, in the time I was talking about, the banking system was weak and there were other problems. Wall Street wasn't very well regulated, and it led to all sorts of other problems. At the moment, Americans have a lot more debt than that middle-class era I write about, and there are more ways to get into debt. So in other words, there's a huge amount of credit card debt. There's a huge amount of student loan debt. There was no such thing as those things in the 1930s. And so as long as most people are employed and working and money is flowing in and so on, they're able to service their debts. And there's also a parallel with respect to small business people, because the Great Depression was so traumatic that a lot of Americans stopped spending except on absolute necessities. And for a lot of small businesses, that meant that their income went down and substantially, so much that they no longer, their business model didn't work anymore. And I'm thinking about smaller small businesses, barbershops. In other words, if times are tough, you don't go to the barber as often. And all of a sudden, if you have lost a third of your business that way, but you still have to pay the rent on the shop or the mortgage on the building and taxes and workers and so on, all of a sudden, if it goes on long enough, you go broke, right? And so, and another example of this has to do with a sudden upswell in political support for the federal government spending money to help the unemployed. And
sounds familiar. Familiar. Exactly. Yeah.
So I think if you're interested in the plight of the middle class and also in the ways that the pandemic has to a degree recreated the conditions that help spur the rise of the middle class, this book might be for you.
Politically now, of course, we're going into congressional elections, a very hotly contested already presidential race. And like I said, Professor, if we were playing a drinking game here, drink whenever you hear the middle class, you know, all those frats and sororities out at Ohio State, they'd have a real good time on the weekend. But, boy, how do you think this all shakes out in November? And also looking back, this really became that middle class vote, right? It wasn't the far left. It wasn't, you know, the uber liberalism of, say, Henry Wallace bordering on socialism and, you know, the far right of Barry Goldwater. It was something really right in the middle, huh?
Right. And a lot of these people were not just middle in terms of income or political philosophy, but also socially and culturally. They were middle of the road people. And the Great Depression came along and suddenly threatened their stability, security, their way of life. And so they became more politically active. And in terms of the election, we'll find out, in other words, the place in the country that was most middle class in terms of the fraction of the population in the era I write about was from about western Pennsylvania through Iowa.
Interesting.
In other words, the greater Midwest. And a lot of those voters last time flipped. And they wanted to try something new. They were frustrated, especially white middle-class voters, and enough of them voted for Donald Trump to carry him to victory. And the Democrats, of course, have put up a candidate this time who has a very middle-class background. In other words, he served as a senator for a long time, and many people in the Senate are very affluent. And they actually nicknamed Joe Biden Middle-Class Joe because he not only came from a middle-class background, but he still sort of was middle class.
Yeah, he doesn't. He's not one of these uber rich guys. He's not.
And the way you can tell that is he owns one house, which is a very middle class concept, and it's his one main investment, right? And that he said this in the vice presidential debate, the first one in back in 2008, which is a very middle class idea. Some folks, John McCain, Mitt Romney, others, have like multiple homes, and so not a very middle-class idea. And so And so the Democrats have put up someone who knows what the middle class is like, and in theory relates well to them. We'll see how well he does. But the point is, I think you will hear a lot about them, the middle class, in the fall. And in terms of the parties, it's really very interesting. In 1932, the Republican Party was mad at President Hoover. Career professional Republican politicos never really liked him. Hoover was pushed to the nomination in 1928 by the business wing. And they viewed him as not an effective communicator on radio, long speeches on dull subjects.
Yeah.
And not a natural for politics. In other words, he was more of an administrator by temperament and training, and done a very good job running the Commerce Department in the 20s. But he was not a natural for politics. And so their fear was, in 1932, that he would drag them, the party itself, down to defeat. And in the 20s, the Republicans were very dominant at the national level,
yes, yeah,
in Congress and so on. And then very quickly that all went away, right? And the Democrats became the new majority party.
Mm.
And so there is a parallel in terms of, if the president can't seem to get more traction in terms of what he's doing with the economy and the pandemic, and the two are related, and voters get mad in that broad middle, especially in the Midwest,
yeah,
it has the potential to drag down a lot of Republicans seeking re-election.
History,
history
perhaps repeating itself. Professor, we're short on time. We do thank
sure.
you. From The Ohio State University, got to make sure I say that, Professor David Stebbin, name of the book, Promised Land, How the Rise of the Middle Class Transformed America from 1929 to 1968. Folks, pick it up wherever you get your books, Amazon.com and all that. Professor, thank you. It's been fascinating. Good luck, and hopefully we'll chat down the road. Thank you.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Thanks, bye-bye. Professor. Yep, Ohio State University Professor David Stebbin. Boy, folks, huh? Talking about stuff from 1929 to 1968. We're going through it all over again. Isn't that wild? Interesting story that broke earlier in the week, but it kind of was buried in everything else we have going on with social unrest and with COVID-19 and all this. But the New York affiliate of Planned Parenthood said it is going to remove the name of its founder, Margaret Sanger, from its Manhattan building because of her support for eugenics. That's kind of a quiet little admission that was made earlier in the week by Planned Parenthood. And joining us right now to talk about that from EWTN, you know, that's a Catholic channel on your streaming provider, your satellite, your cable service. Kate Scanlon produces the Pro-Life Weekly. Kate, hi. Paul here at WICC. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Were you surprised at this? This is kind of a big moment here for Planned Parenthood. Of course, you know, the background of Margaret Sanger, Kate, has been debated for a long time. And Planned Parenthood folks have kind of bitten their lip about this. Was this surprising to you?
I think it's fascinating more than it's surprising. Margaret Sanger's affiliation with the eugenics movement is well-documented historical fact. This is far from, you know, the right-wing conspiracy that Planned Parenthood has loved to characterize it as up to this point. But for them to go so far as to strip the name of their founder from one of their largest facilities is quite a change of tone from them.
Kate, if you could just, for people that might not know it, explain the theory of eugenics, what that is, how that has been connected to Planned Parenthood, and the impact that it's had, particularly on the African-American community.
Absolutely. So eugenics is the ideology that you can kind of manipulate the human race through selective breeding practices. So Margaret Sanger, for example, categorized people into what she called fit and unfit. And there were people who were fit to have children, and there were people who were not, in her worldview. And this is alarming. This should concern not only African Americans, but the poor, Catholics, immigrants. All of these are groups Margaret Sanger wanted less of. And that really informed her vision for shaping the organization that became Planned Parenthood.
So did she, was this, I mean, you have to dig for it to find out about it now, Kate, but was this in the forefront of what she said and taught back then? Was this the kind of thing that was, hiding in plain sight here, as it were?
It absolutely is hiding in plain sight. This is not a revelation by any means. She wrote in her autobiography about her experience speaking at a KKK rally. So this should come as a surprise to no one, because this evidence has been there all along.
Why has she, at least up until now, why has she, by the pro-choice movement and Planned Parenthood, why has she been held in such, I don't know what else the term would be, high esteem here, Kate, for so long?
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Well, she's a trailblazer for them. You know, I mean, she's the one who kind of coined the term birth control, and she made a lot of progress for the pro-choice movement. And so I don't think they wanted to lose their patron saint.
Now, this has to do with the New York local, as it was, or the New York affiliate of Planned Parenthood. So is any other indication, Kate, that this would go nationwide or not? Or is this kind of a little, a test run here? What do your sources say to that?
So I think that's a fascinating question, and I think this is a little bit of a test run. For example, the national organization has not, up to this moment in time, indicated what's to become of their annual Maggie Awards that they give out that are named for their founder. People like Hillary Clinton and Nancy Pelosi have received these awards, so I think there will be questions in the coming weeks as to whether or not the national organization will take any steps to renounce their founder.
Kate, I guess they're worried now, especially in New York, in the midst of everything that's going on here with the tragic death of George Floyd and everything. Was this done to avoid the spotlight of how many million African-American babies have been aborted over the years? Are they doing this out of fear? What exactly caused this, do you know?
Well, I think it's an attempt on their part to kind of reframe the conversation. They want to be able to kind of come out and say, oh, look, we're taking this seriously. We're removing Margaret Sanger's name from our facility. And unfortunately, in many quarters, those very questions about how will Margaret Sanger's work, how does your day-to-day work going to be impacted by this, they've yet to answer that.
Interesting. She produces the EWTN's Pro-Life Weekly. Katie Scanlon has been the guest. Katie, thank you. Appreciate the time on short notice. We appreciate it. Thanks.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Katie. Appreciate it. Well, there you go. Kate Scanlon from the EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. Yeah, Margaret Sanger, the patron saint of Planned Parenthood. Very quietly, the New York Planned Parenthood branch has removed Sanger's name from its Manhattan building because of her support for eugenics. And how look at the number of black babies that have been aborted by Planned Parenthood over the years. Just saying, doesn't sound like they're too woke.
And taking the lead on finding a possible solution to this COVID crisis. Pfizer's been here for a while. And they're not here on purpose. I mean, this is a state that was ranked fourth best in the country in innovation, fourth best in the country in innovation by Bloomberg, fourth best in the country because of what we do in life sciences and bioscience and what Pfizer is doing right here and right now. And you're reminded by this amazing announcement how important Pfizer and the rest of our life sciences are going forward. John was just giving me the, rundown. Look, Pfizer is one of the lead horses in this race right now. There may be several winners. We need several winners. And Pfizer is not just developing the vaccine, going through the protocols, going through the testing, hoping that we're going to have something that's ready for final FDA approval as early as October in time. This is a warp speed, and it's remarkable what they've been able to do. And it's not the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. We still, along the way, have to make sure we're following all the protocols that make Connecticut one of the best in the country in terms of a low infection rate. But it gives us hope, and it gives us hope that science is going to lead us the way past this, as we have in so many other cases. I want to say, on a personal note, Look, I've been pretty tough on the federal government, and I thought their response to PPE and masks and gowns and even testing was discombobulated and leaving it all up to the states. And we took the lead on this, and the states, worked through different success rates depending on where you were. But a little credit where credit's due. I think the federal government's been really proactive and thoughtful as regards what we're doing with life sciences, what we're trying to do with therapeutics, what we're trying to do with vaccines. They've taken the lead. They put in place the incentives. They've offered that they're going to be there to make the purchase as soon as things are done. It's a good, we are going to have a national stockpile. And maybe, before the end of this year, we're going to have billions of doses that we're able to do. They've worked in close partnership with academia and the major life sciences and pharma companies, including Pfizer, which I think gives us a running head start in terms of where we would be otherwise. John, I have a special thanks to Pfizer, though, because not only did you take the lead on developing a vaccine that has the best chance of any in the country of working, and we're going to know that sooner rather than later, but you're also putting your money where your mouth is. And I come out of the business world, and there's a lot of risk. And you can say, let's wait. Let's see how the clinical trials go. Let's wait and see what the FDA approval process looks like. Then we'll start manufacturing, and maybe sometime next year we'll be able to have the doses we need to keep people safe. And that's not the way Pfizer did it. Pfizer's taken a fair amount of risk. And they're rolling the dice, and they're ramping up manufacturing right now, creating the doses. And they're doing that because it's the right thing to do. And they're doing that because if we can get this through the FDA approval process, it's going to be on an expedited basis, not a rush, but an expedited basis, so that we go through all the testing, all the protocols. When we get something released, we know it's effective, and we know that it's safe. We know that Pfizer is going to have the capacity we need to get those vaccines out where we need it. We were just talking, we're going to do everything we can at the state level when that time comes, working with the pharmacies, making sure they have all the capability they need to be able to get you the vaccines fast and efficiently as possible. I just want to say, John, in introducing you and the rest of the Pfizer team, on behalf of our amazing delegation here, I'm so proud of what you've been able to do. You know, this has been a cloud hanging over our country for quite some time, our world, in a sense that these pandemics, we thought we had them in control, and then it flares up again. And it just gives us a great sense of hope that working with Pfizer, working with the life sciences, you working down in New Haven, you've got that partnership there, you've got Yale New Haven Hospital nearby, able to do testing on the therapeutics. We are going to get through this. We're going to get through it together with an amazing partnership with companies like Pfizer. I'm proud you guys are working here. It's an amazing place to be. Thanks, everybody.